stay with me for a while. This is the Bleak Theology Podcast, an ongoing conversation about God, sorrow, literature, the arts, and culture. I'm your host, Bert Gerstenschlager. Before I get into today's labyrinth, I want to thank everyone who has taken the time to download and listen to my trailer and first episode. I hope to be releasing episodes every other Friday, so if you subscribe, you'll be sure not to miss them. I also am thinking about ways how people can support the podcast if they want to, so I'll be sure to let you know about that. I want to begin today with a story that you may already know, but probably haven't thought about in a while. Imagine a cave, and far down in this cave are people chained since childhood against a wall. Up above and behind them is a large bonfire, and between the fire and the prisoners are free people moving about, who are like puppeteers holding various objects above them, moving them to and fro to cast shadows. And these shadows are all the prisoners are able to ever see. And sometimes the puppeteers talk to one another, their voices echoing off the walls of the cave. It is all the prisoners are able to hear. And the prisoners name the shadows and believe that the shadows and the echoes are the actual things themselves. It is very sophisticated, this understanding of shadows, and there's a science to it, and it all makes sense. It's all true. Then, one day, someone comes and breaks a prisoner free from their chains and leads them by hand up toward the surface. And the prisoner keeps ascending out of the only world they have ever known. And they come out of the cave, and the midday sun blinds them with its overwhelming rays. And bird songs cut through the air, and the hiss of a river is like a monster. Yet eventually, the person adjusts to this world, to this real world. Things are seen for what they are, understood for what they are. This individual now perceives the truth. Now eventually, the person begins to think back of about their old life and those that they left and who are still in chains. And they want to share this knowledge and freedom that they have. They return to the cave, entering a now unfamiliar, blinding darkness. And the individual tells their old community what they have experienced and now know. But the chained people only laugh at them in disbelief and deride them for their foolishness and ignorance. And the prisoners say that the one who is now free has returned with damaged eyes. And the prisoners say that anyone who would try to bring them out of their cave, to take them from their prison and chains, should be caught and killed. This famous story, told by Socrates, is the allegory of the cave from Plato's Republic. Perhaps you've read it in an intro philosophy class, or if you've watched The Matrix, or even read The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. There are countless retellings. It's an important story, demonstrating our enduring desire not just to know the real and the true, but to be confident that there exists a real and the true. The story acknowledges the risk of leaving one's familiar, safe world for the unknown and the hoped to be known. I share this allegory because I want to address the very serious matter of learning the world, changing that understanding of the world, and dealing with the fallout. In this case, I'm talking about the so-called biblical worldview of evangelicals and the resultant fallout that are the ex-evangelicals and this thing called deconstruction. Now, this is all part of one of the most defining aspects of American society. And the identity and role of American evangelicalism is complex and deeply interwoven in who we are as Americans. Yet paradoxically, Americans suffer a significant blind spot about not only evangelicalism, but religion in general. And this is something I'll get into in a future episode. And in this episode, to get from A to B and beyond, I must run through time, sometimes multiple decades, in a single sentence. And as an academic and writer, this kills me, but I want to at least mention where we have been in religion to analyze where we are and how it is ultimately worse than we think. First, the history lesson. Because it is a history that many Americans, including evangelicals, just do not know. In the last decade, we have seen a real cultural shift of evangelicals reconsidering the socio-religious environment in which they were raised. And these evangelicals are often those who grew up in the 90s and early aughts, sometimes earlier. And they were the cannon fodder of the culture wars. And they've gotten enough attention in their self-criticism that the evangelical establishment has now taken notice, dismissing, deriding, and chastising them for their questions and their revolt. Now, evangelicalism understands itself as having always been the faithful remnant of the church. And evangelicalism per se has been around since the New World's first religious refugees and colonizers, all the way through the revivalist Great Awakenings and beyond. The kind of evangelicalism that we see now is arguably only about a century old. Worried about the rise of German so-called higher criticism, which treated and analyzed the Bible like any other text, and confronted with liberal theologies like the social gospel, and threatened by Darwinism's dismissal of a literal first Adam, influential conservative clergy and scholars met in Philadelphia and created a series of documents called The Fundamentals, which laid out, point by point, their fundamental beliefs about the Christian faith. And thus fundamentalism was born. A little later, in 1925, this schism played out most vividly in a Tennessee courtroom where education, religion, science, culture, and law collided while all the nation listened on their radios. Science teacher John Scopes lost the case, but the broader verdict was clear. The modernists, both secular and religious, had won. And the fundamentalists withdrew, creating their own schools, Bible colleges, and seminaries. And the tale of the monkey trial became legend. After World War II, a new kind of evangelical arose, a new kind that did not withdraw, but was world savvy enough to engage with the secular world to win it over. Handsome Billy Graham and the academic Carl Henry preached, taught, and built a comprehensive and countercultural biblical worldview, an understanding of reality granted in a particular, all-encompassing reading of an inerrant Bible. It was anti-modernist, but not a throwback to pre-modern life. Paradoxically, it utilized modern categories to understand itself and convey itself. It was capitalistic, nationalistic, very white, and very manly. And while the liberal mainline denominations hubristically held institutional, political, and cultural power, the white evangelical church grew and gained clout in the halls of government and in the homes of the American public. But white evangelicals mostly snubbed the civil rights movement and gnashed their teeth over how to treat their neighbor in a swiftly changing America. Racist Jerry Falwell created popular segregationist academies where white Christian children could learn free from government's intrusion and free from their neighbors of color. Evangelicals entrenched during the tumultuous 60s and 70s, as Goldwater and Nixon seized on their fears of godless communism, minority infringement upon white power, and an emasculating, deviant youth culture. Soon, searching for a new wedge issue, conservatives made defeating Roe their cause as they battled the burgeoning feminist movement and defeated the Equal Rights Amendment. And by the time of Ronald Reagan, the moral majority had won its seat at the table. The liberal church was in decline. Evangelical theology, culture, and media had become a veritable powerhouse, preaching and teaching a self-contained, self-containing worldview, with white, manly, middle-class American Jesus Christ as its cosmic and terrestrial king. In a shrill dog whistle to his religious base during his 1989 farewell address, Reagan evoked the Pilgrim John Winthrop citation of the Gospel of Matthew when he called America a shining city upon a hill. If not a light unto the nations, then evangelical America has certainly become a beacon for itself. Well, growing up in the 1980s in a small Texas town, I didn't know about any of this. I wasn't evangelical, but evangelicalism, specifically a mix of Southern Baptist and fundamentalism, was the air available to breathe. And when I started asking questions for myself as a late teenager, evangelicalism was the only game in town that seemed to care. And I didn't know where else to go for answers. And when it was offered, I inhaled, because I didn't know any better. And I was introduced to a worldview that worked hard to make sense for me and my salvation. But it was a rocky 3 years. And those who actually grew up in that evangelical echo chamber and had only known that world and worldview, it has been a hell of a lot rockier. Blake Chastain struck a nerve in 2016 when he coined the portmanteau hashtag exvangelical. And he's told straight white American Jesus' co-host Bradley Onishi that he did this to create a safe space for people to find solidarity with others who have gone through similar experiences. People who had grown up within evangelicalism suddenly had an accessible, evocative term to describe their exodus. The insertion of the single letter X captured who they had been and who they were now, and it said everything needed about the beliefs, worldview, and the culture. If you know, you know. And by evangelicals' innate social media nature, it was visible, shareable, relatable. It was built for Twitter. It was language of the inside outsider and the outside insider. Exvangelical can be about an atheist, agnostic, someone who has left and gone to a more liberal denomination. It doesn't matter. But it has definition. I also like exvangelical because it deeply upsets the evangelical world. The establishment knows exactly what this world means and what it's about. And for an institution concerned with the numbers of souls saved, the number of bodies in the pews, and the masses to be mobilized, exvangelical hits them where it hurts. It's more significant than the word post-evangelical. It's not just after evangelicalism. is decisively no longer evangelical. And all the while are the ex-evangelicals who hold within themselves the hurt of history, trauma, and the disillusion of God, church, and salvation. In college in the mid-90s, I was reading existentialism, and I realized I wanted to study theology and was advised to study classical civilization to gain a better understanding of the New Testament world. And I began to think critically in active self-reflection about myself and my relationship to God and to the world. And having missed much of the academic theory wars, I discovered Jacques Derrida and his concept of deconstruction without too much controversy. But what I was doing regarding my faith was not Derridean deconstruction. It was the critical thinking required for self-critique and self-examination and re-evaluation of my understanding of the world and my place in it and relation to it. But while I had flirted with evangelicalism, my core understanding of the Bible, God, and the world was not fundamentally and foundationally grounded in that worldview. I was a naive mainliner at best who had discovered existentialism, specifically the existentialism of Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Camus. And because of that, I realized that I am not an ex-evangelical. And I say this not to excuse myself, but to confess that I have not had the distinctly qualifying life experiences that produce the epistemological and existential crises that ex-evangelicals undergo. What I want to focus on is that distinct epistemological and existential crisis that evokes the process of what is now called deconstruction. Now, while deconstruction is a term that has been used in the humanities and social sciences, it has not caught on like it has in the last few years among ex-evangelicals. Even a decade ago, the word was not commonly used except for those of the more philosophical set, and that was mostly if you read John Caputo. But deconstruction, as it is understood and practiced now, is something that comes out of what was once known as the emergent church, that progressive outpouring from evangelicalism since the turn of the millennium. And this deconstruction, as best as I can assess, is the project of the evangelical individual radically and constantly reflecting upon, reevaluating, and reconsidering the biblical worldview that has defined them and shaped them since a significant period of self-understanding in their youth. This reflection touches and intersects with every category and personal aspect of their reality. This reality includes trauma, exploitation, marginalization, and objectification for the benefit of the preservation and perseverance of the biblical worldview and those in power. Deconversion from this world is common, but regardless, the individual never can return to what once was. Now, hopefully, ex-evangelicals and deconstructors will find that definition acceptable. And having grown up among evangelicals and having personally experienced a glancing blow, you have my greatest and enduring sympathy. Deconstruction has caught on in the last decade, and it is hard to pin down its popular origin point, but I do think that it has had some significant evangelists. At the beginning of 2016, two evangelicals, Adam Narlach and John Williamson, began the now popular Deconstructionist podcast for Christians who were wrestling with their faith and were asking serious, unsanctioned questions. The hosts sought to evaluate and test their evangelical worldview. And at the beginning of their first episode, the two discussed the origin of the word deconstruction. And I quote, "So, Let's talk a little bit about where this word originally came from, kind of what the original meaning was, and then how we're going to steal it and take it for our own. Yeah, we're going to do something new with this word. We're going to reclaim it and turn it into something productive. We're going to repurpose it. The two then summarize deconstruction as meaning taking something apart and analyzing it to learn how it is put together and how it works. The hosts then discuss Derrida, who they inaccurately call an existentialist. And the deconstructionists apologize to Derrida for saying his name wrong and say, and I quote, "So sorry, buddy. He's long since gone, and we're totally going to steal his idea and not really do what he wanted us to do with it. Well, he really can't argue with it. That's what philosophy is all about." They say Derrida's deconstruction was about, and I'm quoting here, questioning the system from the inside out. And that's what they use as their foundation, going so far as to say that, quote, "Jesus Christ himself was the ultimate deconstructionist. And the deconstruction is just a really good way of thinking critically and taking a deeper dive into what you hold to be true, and taking ownership of it." And they seek to use deconstruction as a way to create a firm foundation of belief in preparation for difficult times in the believer's life. First off, it's not even worth addressing the mess the two have made, because they themselves have said that they just don't care. And they thought the word sounds cool, and it appeared useful, and so transformed a rudimentary definition for their own purposes. And in a recent episode, the deconstructionists share that they, quote, "could care less about the term, they're not married to it, and that it was given to us," in their words, and that they, quote, "have mad respect for Derrida, love him, and that," quote, "Derrida would probably be totally okay with this." Except he wouldn't. Was it too hard to come up with their own term, or borrow one used since time immemorial? Or was there no term to be used because evangelicalism dissuades such thinking? Stealing, to use their word, the term deconstruction, is like some guy who really loves Richard Marx songs from the 1980s and decides to call the analysis of the lyrics Marxism and doubles down on it. Anyone who has a real clue about Marxism looks at this guy and says, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this? Can't you think of your own word?" But all we can do at this point is to look at the monster that has been created and sigh in frustration and acceptance. I guess we, to quote that great social theorist Richard Marx, should have known better. That two evangelicals would openly and proudly steal a term of art for themselves should not surprise anyone, because appropriating secular concepts and imagery for evangelistic purposes is a basic evangelical practice. Evangelical culture has long thrived on appropriating everything from music trends to advertising slogans and beyond to promote the gospel. But we see this self-privileged appropriation of empty signifiers in other conservative causes and culture wars. Terms like woke and critical race theory have been purposely stripped of their history, context, and cultural and intellectual complexity to serve as shorthand for whatever agenda is desired. The word deconstruction is just one empty vessel among many. Now, thanks in part to the Deconstructionist podcast, the word has taken on a life of its own, but it remains firmly within the evangelical subculture from which it was birthed. 6 years on, deconstruction is now a Christian brand as much as "What Would Jesus Do" and "True Love Waits" ever were. It's not that it's cool and edgy, as supposed by the Gospel Coalition. It's that it deeply resonates and provides timely meaning and resonance in those who would encounter it. Deconstruction has become an identity marker. And if in doubt, see how common it is used on social media profiles. But why do they use deconstruction as their term for critical thinking and self-examination? For the biblical worldview, all knowledge and understanding of the humanities and sciences is in service of evangelical theology. What matters is alignment to the answers already provided within. Christian apologetics, the defense of the faith, especially as popularized by such figures as Josh McDowell and Lee Strobel, provides reassuring foundations for believers. One can only think within and according to the evangelical world's view system. Critical thinking outside the system, worldly understanding, is heresy and sin. Apologetics stands in contrast to deconstruction. But they are two sides of the same coin. The rigorous evaluation of structures to determine what can be considered true and good. Deconstruction is the anti-apologetics trapped in the same evangelical system. As the renowned evangelical historian Mark Knoll famously proclaimed, the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there is not much of an evangelical mind. And the ex-evangelical is painfully aware of that. We might think that the ex-evangelical stumbles out of Plato's cave of shadows, long deceived to see things illuminated by the sun as they truly are. Except that the evangelical worldview is not an inferior version of the truth. The journey out is not to enter into something more real. It is its own world unto itself. And coming out of the cave means to enter another reality all together. This is a trauma of ex-evangelicalism, the real crisis of self in relation to how one once understood oneself in relation to God, self, and society. We see this in the deconstructionist's fascination with academic biblical studies, because all they know is Bible study. We witness their excitement about Richard Rohr because they know nothing about the long tradition of mysticism and monastic community as something good and valuable in Christian history. The evangelical worldview is purposefully constrained and constructed as the church versus the world, and contamination of worldliness is sin. I think this is why when liberals, for lack of a better word, when liberal Christians go to seminary or divinity school, their world does not fall apart so devastatingly when they study the Old and New Testament, and they learn the diversity and history of Christianity, warts and all. The critical thinking skills are already there, and liberal seminaries don't maintain that kind of echo chamber. If anything, hopefully they seek to inculcate the critical skills necessary to recognize it along with the self-examination required for theological competence. The problem for the ex-evangelical is that they must constantly address the hole that evangelicalism has created within them. The abyss is part of them. It's who they are, and no matter what the ex-evangelical does, that void remains there, never to be filled, erased, metabolized, or overcome. They are indeed ex-evangelical, which explains these identity markers all the more. And for all of the escape velocity required and energy expended to become ex-evangelical, and to learn and to become comfortable with critical thinking and self-examination, we exchange the past certainty of one world for the enduring uncertainty of another. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, professor of classics and the son of a minister, in his work The Gay Science, writes an aphorism called The Horizon of the Infinite. And it goes like this. We have left the land and have gone aboard ship. We have broken down the bridge behind us, nay, more, the land behind us. Well, little ship, look out. Beside thee is the ocean. It is true, it does not always roar, and sometimes it spreads out like silk and gold and a gentle reverie. But times will come when thou wilt feel that it is infinite, and that there is nothing more frightful than infinity. Oh, the poor bird that felt itself free and now strikes against the walls of this cage. Alas, if homesickness for the land should attack thee, as if there had been more freedom there, and there is no land any longer. The land of the exvangelical, the world of the exvangelical, is gone. The bridge is smashed. The end of the world has come, yet not the end that has been preached on so many, many Sunday mornings and summer camp starry nights. And what is left? The infinite and the terror of the infinite. And there is a homesickness for land, for a certain kind of certainty, a certain kind of stability, for a world to which there is no return and never shall be. The Bleak Theology Podcast is written and produced by me, Burke Gerstenschlager. Special thanks goes to Adam DJ Brett. Logo design is by Matthew Baker. The music you hear is The Glacial Age by Cryptic Scenery. If what you've heard is meaningful to you, please share the Bleak Theology Podcast wherever you do social media. Liking the podcast and leaving a comment on Apple Music helps me get more attention so more people can learn about it. And links to related material of this episode are available in the show notes. You can follow me on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Bleak Theology, one word. Questions or comments can be sent at bleaktheology.com/podcast. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, peace be with you.